It's Friday, February 16th, 2007.
From Columbia Radio News in New York, this is Uptown Radio. I'm Ellen Gabler.
And I'm Lisa Desai. On today's program, millions of Iraqis left homeless. We'll discuss what the U.S. is doing about the refugee crisis in Iraq.
We'll look at New York's growing population of wrongfully convicted prisoners.
And this is the point when, in our history, when we really need to investigate what's going on here. Why are so many people being wrongfully convicted?
A new program to help ex-convicts get jobs.
With a big gap in the time that I've done, people sort of like frowned on that. It's real hard.
And Harlem in the Himalayas.
What we have here is art that deals with the fundamental human condition, which is what are we doing here?
Those stories and more on Uptown Radio after this news update.
In New York, I'm Henok Fante. Mayor Michael Bloomberg apologized today to drivers in New York who were unhappy with strict parking rules during this week's snowstorm. Thousands of tickets were issued on cars stuck in snowdrifts. The mayor announced in City Hall this morning all tickets will be canceled.
This one, we made a decision, thought that there was not that much snow and that we could do a better job if people did move their cars. I think in retrospect, in some parts of the city, there was not that much snow, and in other parts, it probably really was an imposition.
Bloomberg took a complete U-turn from his position a day earlier, where he dismissed drivers' complaints as mere laziness. The snow is also causing problems for airliner JetBlue. Its passengers have been enduring delays at the airline's struggles to cope with operational meltdown at the John F. Kennedy International Airport. It canceled 71 flights this morning and other flights will be delayed. JetBlue spokesman Brian Baldwin told reporters more cancellations are likely. Passengers at JFK Airport were outraged by the delays and cancellations. The airline was overwhelmed by a medium-sized snowstorm this week. A number of same-sex couples in New Jersey are planning their wedding next week. The Garden State will allow civil unions as of Monday. The decision came at the end of a legal wrangle with gay rights advocates. Supreme Court ordered the state in October last year to offer gay couples the same benefits that married couples receive. The number 7 subway will be out of service this weekend between the 74th Street Roosevelt Avenue stop in Queens and Times Square. The route will remain closed for the next 5 weeks. It's cloudy and windy in New York with a high of 29. This is Henok Fante, Columbia Radio News.
This is Uptown Radio. I'm Lisa Desai.
And I'm Ellen Gabler. 4 years ago, millions of protesters in 600 cities rallied against the U.S. invasion of Iraq. Yesterday, on the anniversary of those protests, more than 24 student groups in the U.S. pledged to keep the opposition alive. From Los Angeles to New York City, these students skipped class and staged teach-ins around a common vision, to end the war. Aileen Humphreys talked to protesters around the country and here at Columbia University. Here's her report.
These students haven't met, but each one of them organized anti-war events on Thursday. From UC Santa Barbara to Occidental College in Los Angeles to Columbia University in New York.
My name's Ellen McClure. I'm a second year at UCSB.
My name is Bill Barney at Occidental College.
Blair Mosner, I'm a senior at Barnard College.
Students said the protests ranged in size from 1,000 in Santa Barbara to a few dozen at UCLA. Ellen McClure said students at the Santa Barbara rally marched toward a nearby freeway, completely blocking an access road to campus, and they were stopped by police. She said a student and a women's studies professor were arrested and that the entire women's studies department closed for the rally. McClure said that after the police run-in, students marched to the administration building where the doors had been locked.
When we got there, the crowd was still really into it, chanting, kind of pounding on the doors, but just really wanting to be heard.
Anti-war events at Occidental College in Los Angeles ran from 8:30 a.m. to 8:30 p.m., says organizer Phil Barney.
I heard from, like, 3 different people that were involved in
that weren't. But it was the most beautiful thing that happened on campus for years.
At Columbia, four fire alarms suspiciously went off near the noon start time of the protest. Organizers had been encouraging students to strike classes to join them. A university spokesman said no one has been caught. When the rally began, students gathered in the bowl at the center of Columbia's campus, at the foot of Lowe Library. Columbia Public Safety says the crowd numbered between 300 and 400 students. Organizer Blair Mosner stood at a microphone on steps above the students.
We are the majority. We are not a marginalized, tiny group of wackos who are against this war.
Another California organizer, Eric Garner, helped organize a die-in at UCLA. Participants were contacted via text message, and when the signal was given,
a whole crowd of people dropped, spread themselves out, and for the next 20 minutes or so, anyone that was walking by had to step over all the bodies. You couldn't just walk. There were too many people to be able to walk by and ignore it.
Students who participated in Thursday's events say they organized around tools like Facebook, which allowed them to find out who was protesting and where. The February 15th protesters also organized around a website set up for the occasion, where they are now keeping track of post-event news coverage and first-person accounts. Denouncing U.S. imperialism seemed to be the hot topic of the day. The protests were much smaller than their inspiration 4 years ago, but students say protesting in solidarity is a step in the right direction. Aileen Humphreys, Columbia Radio News.
The Bush administration announced this week that 7,000 Iraqi refugees will be allowed to resettle in the U.S. The U.N. Refugee Agency is calling Iraq's refugee situation the biggest population displacement in the recent history of the Middle East. I spoke with Eric Gustafson, whose organization called Education for Peace in Iraq is lobbying to open U.S. borders to even more Iraqi refugees.
We're talking about an estimated 3.8 million Iraqis who have been driven from their homes by violence, 1.8 million displaced within the country of Iraq, and approximately 2 million who have fled to neighboring countries, primarily Syria and Jordan.
Now, before this week, only 600 refugees were let into the U.S. since the war began. Can you tell me a bit about why there has been so much reluctance in terms of letting Iraqis into the country?
I mean, I think it reflects the reluctance of the administration to face up to the realities on the ground in Iraq for a long time now. And there's a lot of talk about our obligation to our soldiers, and I'm a veteran, so of course, you know, that's going to resonate with me and a lot of Americans. But you see nothing about our obligation to the people of Iraq, particularly with 3.8 million people who have been displaced by a crisis that the U.S. is partially responsible for.
Now, Governor Ted Strickland of Ohio said he doesn't want any of the refugees to be relocated in Ohio. He said he doesn't want the state to take on any more of the Bush administration's burden. What's your reaction to that?
I mean, it's politics, and it's really unfortunate when you have politicians play politics and people suffer the consequences, whether it's American soldiers that are in Baghdad, in Iraq right now, facing incredible dangers, or it's the Iraqi refugees that are in a desperate situation and desperately need safe sanctuary to go.
And finally, how have efforts in the U.S. to accommodate Iraqi refugees compared to international efforts, specifically in terms of Western countries?
European nations have had to handle an influx of more refugees coming from that region. They are also beginning to tighten their restrictions. What's driving the problem more than anything is the scale of it. I think that the U.S. Could do a lot more. 7,000 is a good start. In addition, the State Department announced that the U.S. would be providing $18 million to the U.N. refugee program, and that's also a step in the right direction, but far more is needed because, again, I mean, think of the numbers. You know, $18 million, 3.8 million displaced families. It's just a drop in the bucket.
Eric Gustafson, thanks for joining us.
My pleasure.
Eric Gustafson is the director of EPIC, that's the Education for Peace in Iraq Center based in Washington, D.C.
If you haven't kept your New Year's resolution, you have another chance. Sunday marks the start of the Lunar New Year, and according to Chinese tradition, it's time to start fresh, with flowers. Gretchen Kuda reports.
It's a Chinese custom to celebrate the New Year with flowers, and so flower markets are an essential part of the celebration. This year's flower market opened today at noon in Chinatown's Columbus Park, marking the start of the weekend's festivities. William Dow is a spokesperson for the Museum of Chinese in the Americas. He says flower markets are popular in a lot of Asian countries.
It's kind of a night market where you go around with your family and friends, enjoy the atmosphere, the energy of the Lunar New Year. And we thought that would be like perfect for New York City, which has one of the largest Chinese populations outside of China.
The blossoming flower is a good sign during the Lunar New Year period, and is also given as a gift.
Wellington Chen is the executive director of the Chinatown Partnership. He says the New Year is a time for a clean slate.
You get your house thoroughly cleaned, you get a new haircut, you get new clothes, you pay off all old debts. If you owe your neighbor money, pay them off now before Lunar New Year. That is the custom and has been the tradition for a long, long time.
According to the Chinese lunar calendar, Sunday is the first day of the year, 4705, or the year of the pig. And that makes this year special. The pig is the last animal in the 12-year cycle and therefore represents closure and completion. Chen says this is important to the residents of New York's Chinatown, who are still working to rebuild their community after 9/11.
It is a refresher, so to speak, a rejuvenation, and it's almost symbolic of Chinatown that we need a symbol of rebirth and a new beginning. And so hopefully there's a new light at the end of the tunnel, and that's what we're aiming for.
As one local flower vendor explains, fa, the word for flower in Cantonese, sounds a lot like the word for fortune.
Fa means it's make money. So everybody in the new year, first day, like to buy the flower.
This is the fourth annual flower market in Chinatown. It is open through Saturday. Gretchen Kuda, Columbia Radio News.
DNA testing has freed almost two dozen innocent people from New York prison since 1992, the highest of any state in the country. Lawyers, advocates, and local leaders are now asking serious questions about what is wrong with New York's criminal justice system, and they're grappling with what should be done about it. Satara Nieves reports.
Roy Brown went to prison 15 years ago for a murder he insisted he didn't commit. Last month, DNA testing proved Brown was right, and he became the eighth innocent person in the past 2 years to be freed by such evidence in New York. Alicia Eckhart is a law student who began working on Roy Brown's case last year through the Innocence Project, a nonprofit legal clinic. She says that cases like Brown's show that New York has a problem.
We're aware that innocent people are in jail, in prison, for many, many years, and this is the point when, in our history, when we really need to investigate what's going on here. Why are so many people being wrongfully convicted?
Many people look at New York's recent exonerations and say there's a simple solution. Do more DNA testing, which offers conclusive proof that someone is innocent. But Eckhart says that DNA testing isn't enough.
Most of the criminal cases in New York are not cases where you're going to have blood, semen, saliva, or other DNA. There's going to be a lot of innocent people who have no course of action after they've been convicted.
Brown's lawyer, Katie Karlovich, says that DNA exonerations provide proof that wrongful convictions aren't rare events. She says one main problem is that New York's criminal justice system simply doesn't have enough checks and balances.
The exonerees at the Innocence Project has dealt with, it's a tip of the iceberg type of situation. Peter Neufeld from the Innocence Project likes to say, you know, if there was a doctor where there's a couple surgeries that go bad, there's an agency that steps in and investigates the circumstances to make sure it doesn't happen again.
New York Assemblyman Michael Janaris of Astoria is trying to create such an agency to step in. He's sponsoring a bill to establish an Innocence Commission, which would examine exoneration cases and make policy recommendations to try to make sure more innocent people don't spend decades in prison. Rebecca Brown from the Innocence Project says this idea isn't new. Innocence commissions already successfully exist in six states.
The public finds it horrifying to think that this could happen to them, but also more than that, that this is just something that could happen, you know, in a free democracy where we believe that systems are in place to ensure that an innocent is never convicted wrongfully. So I think really sort of provides, you know, an extra check or balance on the justice system.
Janaris' legislation would create a commission of 10 people representing law enforcement, judges, defense attorneys, and academics. These appointees would identify the major causes of wrongful convictions in New York and implement reforms to make sure that fewer innocent people get trapped in the system. But for now, Roy Brown serves as living proof of why New York needs such a commission. His lawyer, Katie Karlovich, describes how difficult Brown's life is after 15 years behind bars.
He had children that were small when he was first locked up. These children are grown. Some have children of their own. We went to the bank to open an account, and I was trying to explain an ATM card to him. He hasn't emailed anybody. He's trying to get used to using a cell phone. The world changes so much in that time frame.
Brown and others freed by the state of New York by DNA evidence have served a total of 249 years in prison for crimes they never committed. Assemblyman Generis's legislation for an innocence commission will be introduced for the 2007 session this month. This is Sitara Nieves for Columbia Radio News.
State and city lawmakers want to make it easier for ex-convicts to get a job. Legislation is being proposed that offers monetary incentives, like tax breaks and wage subsidies, for companies that hire former felons. But some say it's an abuse of taxpayers' dollars. My colleague Ellen Gabler has this report.
Marcos Pope hasn't had a job in 18 years. He was released from prison in July after serving nearly two decades for trafficking guns and drugs. The 55-year-old said he worked as a medic in the Air Force before doing time. Now, he can't convince anyone to hire him.
With the big gap in the time that I've done, people sort of like frowned on that. It's basically, it's real hard.
Pope says he applies to about four or five jobs each week. Kitchen work, fast food cashier, bike messenger, but usually doesn't hear back. He says he is honest and just wants a second chance.
Some guys leave penitentiary and they have definite ideas of staying in the street and continue to hustle. I have, you know, no inclination of doing that. And yet still, it's so very hard to, you know, to find work.
Early this month, New York City Council member Letitia James introduced a resolution designed to keep people like Marcos from returning to a life of crime. Each year, more than 27,000 people are released from New York State prisons. Within 3 years, about two-thirds are rearrested. James says recently released felons often can't get jobs, become economically frustrated, then reoffend.
We are paying for their incarceration. We are paying for it out of our tax dollars, and it is increasingly becoming very, very expensive. We are paying more now to construct prison jails and maintain them in the state of New York, in the city of New York, more money than we are paying for higher education and or more money than we're paying for public education.
The legislation would add to existing tax credits provided by the federal government. Companies can currently receive a $2,400 tax break per employee, or up to $25,000 each year. Several cities throughout the country have recently enacted similar legislation. Companies in Philadelphia can get a $5,000 tax credit for every former felon they hire. New York's proposed plan does not yet detail how much businesses could receive. Councilmember James said she also does not know how much the program would cost. The idea is likely, however, to hit some opposition. Chairman of the New York State Conservative Party, Mike Long, said his group would speak out against it.
That this is just another form of welfare, and it's an unfair burden to reach into the taxpayers' pockets to subsidize businesses who hire people who have served time in jail. It's absolutely ludicrous.
Not everyone agrees. Neil Pantelatos manages Strokos Deli in Morningside Heights. He said he'd consider hiring someone with a criminal record, and not just for the extra cash.
If I can help one person, you know, and everybody chipped in a little bit by helping a person or more than one person, you know, I personally believe it would bring crime down, and it would do better for the city overall.
The city council is expected to discuss the resolution this year. State lawmakers are likely to do the same. This is Ellen Gabler, Columbia Radio News. One of the world's poorest countries has a rich field of long-distance running talents. Over the past 20 years, in the East African nation of Ethiopia, running has become a tradition and the nation's sense of pride. At the U.S. indoor track meet earlier this month, a 21-year-old Ethiopian runner, Tirunesh Dibaba, broke the world indoor record for the 5,000-meter in Boston. She brought the stadium to its feet as she surged forward in a record-breaking final lap. Henok Fente was there and sent us this report.
It was freezing cold outside, but at the Madison Square Garden in New York, and especially at the Reggie Lewis Center in Boston, immigrant Ethiopians had a lot to cheer for. The stadiums were packed with fans wrapped in the green, yellow, and red national flag. people chanted and danced to Ethiopian folk song played by a DJ. More than 15,000 Ethiopian immigrants live in the Boston area, and a few thousand in New York. Most of them work in parking garages, restaurants, and other blue-collar jobs. Tashoma Damalash is an Ethiopian who had lived in Boston for 20 years. He says the community struggles with issues of low wages and family separation, among others. But on race day, they're all winners.
It's so great for us because our athletes from our country are always here and winning and inspiring us once again. We always wish that we win in some other aspects of our society as well.
The community, to a certain extent, is politically and tribally divided. But at the stadium, they all have one voice.
Through church, through sports, through all kinds of activities, we always try to connect and cherish our victories, share our sorrows, and think about our beloved motherland, Ethiopia. There is going to be an event tonight. There is going to be a big bash, a band going all night long. It's in their honor as well. All of us are going to be there honoring them, appreciating what they did.
Parents in the community also use this opportunity to introduce their kids that were born and raised in America with Ethiopian culture. Among the crowd was 7-year-old Lydia Tasfai, a second-generation Ethiopian. She had come to watch the race with her father, who wants her to develop an Ethiopian identity.
The Ethiopian runners are better than Americans. It's because the Ethiopian has more blood and they have more energy.
More blood or perseverance, record or no record, long-distance running events have become an important social occasion in the immigrant Ethiopian community in North America. People are waiting for future races to forget the ordeals of life and put a smile on their difficult life in exile.
That was Henok Fente reporting.
New York is an international destination for artists and musicians. A unique collaboration between two of New York's newer art institutions, the Jazz Museum of Harlem and Chelsea's Rubin Museum of Himalayan Art, brings together floating Buddhas and Harlem jazz musicians. Bilal Qureshi reports.
The simple pleasures of a cornet, bass, and a Cole Porter composition streaming through an elegant theater in Chelsea. Jazz remains a quintessential New York art form. Its roots in the city date back to the Smoky Lounges in Harlem, where Miles Davis and Dizzy Gillespie first charmed audiences in the 1940s and 50s. But this performance is being called Harlem in the Himalayas, the result of a unique collaboration between two of New York's newer art institutions, the Jazz Museum in Harlem and Chelsea's Rubin Museum of Himalayan Art. Tim McHenry directs programming at the Rubin and says the museum's displays of rare Buddhist, Islamic, and Tibetan art from the Himalayas are really meditations on universal ideas.
What we have here is art that deals with the fundamental human condition, which is, what are we doing here? While it is traditional in form, it becomes contemporary the moment you put a living person in front of it.
And the Rubin hopes it's jazz evenings like this one that will bring new viewers into the museum and keep these works relevant. At the bottom of the elegant sixth-floor gallery, musician Warren Vache entertains a crowd sitting on candle-lit tables in the museum's chic theater. Behind him, projected images of Buddhist mystics are floating on the wall. Vache says he chose to perform as part of the series for two reasons.
A check and a payday.
As for the Himalayan art, he's indifferent.
So I confess complete ignorance as to the artistic exhibit and what's going on upstairs. I didn't get a chance to see it at all, bad person that I am.
Jazz enthusiasts like David French come to the Rubin to hear Harlem music performed without amplification in an intimate and focused setting.
I mean, it's much preferable to a jazz club where people are talking and drinking.
By the end of the night, the consensus about the music's connection to the Himalayas remains decidedly mixed. Some musicians have drawn direct inspiration from the art, and others, like Vache, none at all. Programming director Tim McHenry admits that it's a mixed bag week to week.
not everyone has hit the target. But then again, when you're asking people to do new things, you don't gain anything unless you want to take the risks.
And the risks seem to be paying off. Harlem in the Himalayas is in its second year, and the series continues to draw sellout crowds and high-profile performers. As for why jazz has found a home among the Rubin Museum's Buddhist statues and Tibetan paintings, Jazz Museum Director Lauren Schoenberg credits the multicultural roots of the music itself.
There's something inherent in the sound that reflects the multi-stranded, heterogeneous roots that speaks to people about the coming together of seeming opposites.
Bilal Qureshi, Columbia Radio News.
You're listening to Uptown Radio. There's more to come. Stay with us. Columbia Radio News, this is Uptown Radio. I'm Ellen Gabler.
And I'm Lisa Desai. Coming up,
hundreds of women head to Madison Square Garden to get screened for a disease that often goes undetected until it's too late.
A marketing move lands the clothing store Urban Outfitters in the middle of one of the world's longest-running conflicts.
And the Westminster Dog Show kicks off. We'll take you there. But first, these headlines.
I'm Aileen Humphreys. Democrats succeeded this afternoon in passing a measure opposing President Bush's proposed troop increase. 17 Republicans voted for the non-binding resolution. 2 Democrats opposed it. New York Democrat Elliot Engel spoke out against Iraq with his fellow party members.
This is more and more like Vietnam. You can't leave and you can't stay. The surge won't work.
President Bush wants to add at least 21,000 troops to the war in Iraq. In the war that will be 4 years old next month, more than 3,100 U.S. troops have died. State Farm Insurance stopped selling two kinds of insurance in Mississippi today. The company will no longer sell homeowners and commercial insurance in the state that was battered by Hurricane Katrina in 2005. The company blames increased litigation after the storm as one reason for pulling out. Mississippi's Attorney General Jim Hood said today he would try to block State Farm's insurance freeze. Reporter Chris Bragg has a report about JetBlue's woes since the Valentine's Day snowstorm in New York. He talks to a JetBlue passenger who was delayed flying from Las Vegas to New York.
JetBlue travelers at JFK Airport continued to experience delays for the third straight day. At least 71 flights were canceled today, and JetBlue expects more problems. Matt James had his flight delayed for 4 hours. He says the scene at JFK was chaotic.
I probably saw about 50 to 100 people sleeping on the ground. A lot of people seemed really frustrated. A lot of people just sitting, just staring.
Some passengers had to sit on the tarmac for 10 hours. JetBlue has offered them refunds and free round-trip tickets. Chris Bragg, Columbia Radio News.
Beleaguered Air America Radio, a liberal talk radio station, was sold today for $4.25 million. A bankruptcy judge approved the sale. The station failed to make a profit after it was founded in 2004. The United States Treasury announced today it would freeze bank accounts of 3 Iranian companies accused of aiding Iran's nuclear weapons program. The move also prevents Americans from having a business relationship with the companies. The high in New York today was 27 degrees. Tomorrow, expect a high of 35 degrees in the 5 boroughs. In world weather, the high tomorrow in Havana will be 73 degrees. The high in Mexico City, 72. The high in New Delhi, 69. The high in Paris, 59 degrees.
This is Uptown Radio. I'm Lisa Desai.
And I'm Ellen Gabler. One out of every 5 New Yorkers is uninsured. President Bush has proposed a plan involving tax deductions so that more people will be able to afford health insurance on their own. But it is uncertain whether the proposal will help most of New York's 1.5 million uninsured residents. Irene J. Liu reports.
When Tim Moss was healthy, he never thought of health insurance as a necessity.
Being an entrepreneur, health insurance has kind of like been a luxury. That's how I've viewed it, was if I can afford it, I'll get it then. but I've got to cover this and that expense and this one and that one and this one.
But Moss's business fell on hard times, and he could no longer afford to pay for health insurance. His health deteriorated.
Because I knew I didn't have any health insurance, and I could not go to a doctor, and I didn't want to go to the hospital simply because of bills. So I held off as long as I could. I ended up vomiting blood.
When he finally was able to get help, the stress of not having insurance only worsened his condition.
There were times, I'm serious, on the subway where, I mean, I just felt totally hopeless. There was absolutely, because I didn't have any medical insurance. I was getting bills constantly from the hospitals for like $70,000, and which added more stress. And it was just the most horrible period of my life. It truly, truly was.
Healthcare costs are at an all-time high, and insurance is too expensive for the poor, especially low-income workers and their families. The president proposes a tax deduction that would help the uninsured to buy insurance on their own. Advocates of the Bush proposal say that the tax deduction makes the cost of health insurance more transparent and will put money in the pockets of those who do not have health insurance from their employers. But even the Bush administration acknowledges that this plan will only help a fraction of the 45 million uninsured in America. Moreover, some observers say Bush's tax plan will not help those who need health insurance the most. In New York, for instance, two-thirds of the city's uninsured are low-income workers and their families.
The people in New York who are uninsured tend to be low-income and not have much of a tax liability.
Linda Blumberg is with the Urban Institute, a liberal think tank in Washington, D.C. She points out that many of the city's uninsured don't pay taxes in the first place.
So this is not a policy that's going to have a big impact on reducing the number of uninsured.
Advocates for the uninsured aren't the only ones who are concerned about the Bush plan. Some employers say that the health coverage they now provide to employees may be in jeopardy.
It's bad now when we're operating on a 1% to 2% profit margin, and it's tough now for us to provide benefits. But if costs spike as a result of flight from employer plans, then I think you would see a lot of retailers be forced to back away from coverage.
Neil Trotwine is a healthcare lobbyist for the National Retail Federation, which represents the retail industry, one of America's largest employers of low-income workers. Trotwine says the retail industry already faces a number of obstacles in its effort to ensure employees.
We have to stay open 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. We have to employ a lot of part-time people. We've got folks who work multiple jobs. It's just a hard workforce to cover.
The Democrats in Congress have vowed to fight Bush's proposal. For the uninsured, relief will most likely come not from the federal government, but from the states. California and Massachusetts are developing programs to provide health care for all. And in New York, health care reform is at the top of Governor Eliot Spitzer's agenda. For Columbia Radio News, this is Irene J. Liu.
The popular clothing store Urban Outfitters has made its name selling hip clothes to teens and 20-somethings. Late last year, the store started selling the kafia, a checkered scarf commonly worn by men in Arab countries. But nothing is simple when it comes to the Middle East. The marketing of the scarf provoked protests, and Urban Outfitters quickly pulled the scarf off its website. Lily Jamali has the story.
The picture on Urban Outfitters' website showed a young blonde man wearing a military-style jacket and the kafia around his neck. The text labeled the product as an anti-war woven scarf, a term Layla Al-Khatani says just doesn't apply. She's the spokeswoman for the Arab American Anti-Discrimination Committee, an advocacy group based in Washington.
You know, I don't agree with what they've labeled it or marketed it as. It doesn't have anything to do with an anti-war. You know, I don't necessarily see why they would be doing that. Some sort of marketing ploy, I would guess.
Marketing ploy or not, the scarf sold well, part of the military chic look Urban Outfitters has helped make popular in cities from London to Los Angeles. The kafia was originally used by Arab men to protect them against the brutal Middle Eastern sun. Its most popular model, Yasser Arafat, the former leader of the Palestinian Liberation Organization. He was often pictured wearing a kafia, and largely because of Arafat, the kafia has become associated with the Palestinian cause. But its political significance has been lost on some, like Columbia University junior Jared Drucker, who bought his at Urban Outfitters over Christmas break.
I thought it was a little different looking, and I've seen a few people wearing it, and I liked it. So, yeah.
That's exactly what worried Nadim Muadi, a Palestinian blogger who writes for KebabFest.com, which caters to Arab Americans.
When I saw it just marketed, just mass production like that, I knew that all of a sudden people are going to start wearing the keffiyeh and not know what the meaning is, especially since the website wasn't telling people what the keffiyeh meant and why people, other people were wearing it.
Complaints by some in the Jewish community were much angrier. They were upset not by the way the keffiyeh was marketed as an anti-war scarf, but by the fact that Urban Outfitters was selling it at all. Beth Gottfried wrote about it on her blog.
You know, look, this is a symbol of, terrorist groups. And I think sort of like that, especially in this like post, 9/11 world, like seeing that, and sort of like attaching significance to it in that way, I think it's offensive in that way.
The Jerusalem Post has reported that the CEO of Urban Outfitters emailed a pro-Israel activist who complained, saying that no one at his company meant to support terrorists and that they would stop selling the scarf. A spokeswoman from Urban Outfitters declined to answer questions about whose complaints finally spurred them to pull the item. But the company has posted a message for anyone who searches for the scarf on their website. It reads, "Due to the sensitive nature of this item, we will no longer offer it for sale. We apologize if we offended anyone. This was by no means our intention." Meanwhile, the scarf still sells at Urban Outfitters in Europe. Lily Jamali, Columbia Radio News.
It's been 5 years since the United States first sent men it deemed enemy combatants to the prison at Guantanamo Bay. Last January, Deputy Assistant Secretary of Defense Charles Stimson spoke on Federal News Radio, an online radio station, warning law firms that if they continue to defend detainees, their legal practices will suffer. The Bush administration immediately distanced themselves from the comments, and shortly after, Stimson resigned. Tanya Haas reports.
During the radio interview, Charles Stimson named more than 20 American firms representing Guantanamo detainees. Stimson chastised these firms for spending time and money on men accused of being a threat to national security, especially, he said, when the federal government offers the prisoners what he calls very good military legal representation. The scolding continued when radio host Jane Norris asked who was paying for the detainees' corporate law firm representation.
It's not clear, is it? Some will maintain that they're doing it out of the goodness of their heart, that they're doing it pro bono, and I suspect they are. Others are receiving monies from who knows where, and I'd be curious to have them explain that.
Joshua Colangelo O'Brien's law firm has been representing detainees for 3 years. He says his New York firm uses 3% of the annual revenue for pro bono cases, including the defense of 6 Bahraini detainees. He estimates that most law firms spend between $40,000 to $50,000 a year to cover the cost of representation. The figure may seem like a lot of money, but Colangelo O'Brien says that the bill is dwarfed by the overall budgets of corporate law firms. Pro bono work is an essential part of the legal practice in America, he says, and firms, not clients, determine which cases are granted counsel without charge.
It's certainly not the case of significant client funds of any particular client going to this or any other pro bono representation in particular.
Like Colangelo O'Brien, lawyer Neha Singh Gohil disputes Stimson's suggestion that American law firms should stop defending detainees. She says that without pro bono services, the inmates would be floundering. Gohil has helped defend 11 Yemeni detainees since 2004. None of her clients have been formally charged in a court of law. On the rare occasion that she has reviewed the military's case against her clients, this Yale Law School graduate has found the evidence unconvincing and inadequate.
There's very thin evidence here, and I think whatever evidence there is has pretty much been shot by the fact that we're now 5 years out, and that all of it is pretty much tainted by the lack of process that they got, being handed over from one military rep to the other.
Stimson maintains that free military counsel is adequate representation and in line with due process. Mary Kelly Persai edits the Columbia Human Rights Law Review. She considers there to be a conflict of interest in the military representation of detainees. But Persai is not surprised by Stimson's position.
Well, his charge, according to the administration, is certainly not to protect the rights of detainees. That's not the stance of the Bush administration, and that's for the executive to determine. But the whole point is that the law is separate from the executive. We are a government of laws, not men.
Lawyers like Colangelo Bryan and Gohill witness America's frail government of laws every time they visit Guantanamo Bay. Colangelo Bryan has helped six clients get released and returned to their families. It's the 450 men that remain that keep him on the case, regardless of what Stimson says. For Columbia Radio News, I'm Tanya Haas.
New York City Council Speaker Christine Quinn delivered the State of the City address yesterday, outlining a number of initiatives to help middle-class New Yorkers with the high cost of living in the city. I spoke with her today about education and campaign finance reform, as well as tax cuts.
We want to do everything we can to try to keep the middle class in the city and also help folks who want to become part of the middle class, help them get there. And that's why, one, we proposed a tax credit for renters.
I read that $300 tax credit would cost the city about $261 million. But would that $300 really make that much of a difference to the average middle class family in New York?
Well, I think if you're a renter who's had, particularly a working-class renter, who's had your rents go up since 2001 when we had to raise property taxes, and now you're seeing your landlords get a break because property taxes are going down, I don't think it's the overall answer, but I think as part of an equation, it could be very, very helpful and make a difference in people's lives.
Now, you also pledged to reform the city's campaign finance system with restricting contributions from people who do business with the city and closing loopholes on corporate contributions. How big of a problem is this in the city right now?
Well, you know, I don't think it's a problem in the sense that I don't think people have undue influence or anything like that. But I do think it's a problem that there's still the perception that there's undue influence, and even that perception can create a disconnect between government and New Yorkers, and that perception, therefore, you know, really can drive people away from participating in government, and we need to take care of that and address it.
Now, you also proposed a number of educational reforms, some specifically targeting middle schools. Why do you want to focus on middle schools, and what reforms would you like to see?
Well, middle schools are the part of our system that's doing worst. I mean, that's really where we're losing people, either families who are pushing enough money together, scraping hard, working hard, and sending their kids out to private or public schools, or where we start to say, people say, you know, I'm going to move to the suburbs because I can't find a good middle school. They're the part of our schools that really are screaming out for the most reform. Exactly what reforms I want, I don't know. That's why I'm going to pull together a panel of experts to help advise me and the council.
And now, this was your first year as speaker. How happy are you with how the council has operated?
I think we've made a lot of improvements, and I think we've made ourselves more professional, but we're not done. We're not nearly done, and we need to keep pushing to become more relevant and more connected to New Yorkers and the problems in their everyday lives.
What improvements or reforms would you like to see on the council?
Well, you know, I think the biggest thing we need to do is address campaign finance and make sure the reforms of the campaign finance go through. And we also want to continue our reform of the budget process. And this year we're going to move on and expand our work and focus on the capital budget and expand the advocacy and the work we do there.
Finally, several political pundits who were impressed with your speech have speculated that you might have your eye on the next mayoral election. Is there any truth to that?
I have my eye on the second year of being speaker. And that's about the only thing I'm looking at right now.
Christine Quinn is the Speaker of the New York City Council. She joined us by telephone. Madam Speaker, thanks for talking to us today.
Bye.
More women in the U.S. die of heart disease every year than any other illness. February is Heart Awareness Month, and public health officials and doctors are working hard to educate women about this life-threatening disease. Rebecca Kaufman spent this morning with some New Yorkers who are trying to stay healthy.
Christina Camacho says she tries to avoid heart disease. She doesn't smoke, and she's been a vegetarian for 35 years. Still, she worries about her heart. After all, she says, women face multiple stresses every day.
Women play so many roles in their life. We have to take care of our family, husband, and we don't take care of ourselves. We live a very such a stressed life here, running and rushing.
Camacho, a dietitian herself, came to Madison Square Garden this afternoon for a series of free tests that measure heart disease risk,
like weight, cholesterol, and blood pressure. The event was sponsored by the organization Sister to Sister, a group that educates women about heart disease. Jocelyn Graham is here for the second year in a row. Last year, she was told that her blood sugar level was a little high. She's made progress. This morning, she found out that she had lost weight and lowered her blood sugar levels. Graham said it was simple.
I cut out all the white flour, white rice. I use whole wheat cereal, whole wheat brown rice. So I'm doing pretty good.
That's the kind of story Tina Fuchs is hoping to hear more of. She's a nutritionist at St. Vincent's Hospital in Manhattan. She's helping women understand their test results. Fuchs says heart disease is still considered by many to be a man's problem.
We tend to worry more about breast cancer and cancer in general, and I think they just don't have the facts that, you know, this is a major killer of women as well as men. And so, again, it's just we don't focus on our hearts as being a problem.
Fuchs says women who have gone through menopause are more at risk of blocked arteries. On top of that, she says, many women don't even know if they are having a heart attack.
The symptoms of heart attack are different sometimes for women than for men. They tend to be more nauseous. They might have back pain. You know, again, sort of nonspecific symptoms. But so that women don't realize they're having a heart attack.
Guy Milo lives a few blocks away in Chelsea and decided to take advantage of the free test. But he was a little nervous about coming to the all-women's event.
I thought they weren't going to let me in.
They had no reason not to. Heart disease is also the number one killer of men. Rebecca Kaufman, Columbia Radio News.
The annual Westminster Kennel Club Dog Show wrapped up this week with Diamond Jim, an English Springer Spaniel, winning Best in Show. On Tuesday, I visited Madison Square Garden to meet the other competitors and their trainers.
Other than the Kentucky Derby, it is the longest continuously held event, sporting event, in America. People who don't know anything about any dog shows in the whole year long know about Westminster.
This is Mick here, and this is Sammy Joe. I bathed them out this morning and came over here and blow-dried them out and got them all groomed up and fluffy and trimming and all that to get them all ready for showing.
The dog's name is Hero, and he's from North Jersey. And my husband and I, Carol and Dennis Collins, are professional all-breed dog handlers from the Philadelphia, Pennsylvania area. We are actually completely bathing all of his hanging coat so that he will be bathed and lightly spritzed with conditioner and then blow dried so that his coat looks beautiful to walk in the ring today. When my husband brought him over to the table right before we bathed him, I jazzed him up a bit and, you know, we played for a while on the table here, and now it's all business.
I'll see you later, alligator. You be good boy. Mwah. Mama loves you.
That's our show for this week.
Today's show was produced by Jennifer Collins, Tanya Haas, and Sitara Nieves. Lily Jamali is our senior producer.
Irene J. Liu and Bilal Qureshi edited the program. Our web editor is Peter O'Dowd. The executive producer of Uptown Radio is David Gura.
Our advisors are Amy Costello, Rick Carr, and John Dingus. Thanks to Craig Hedick and Josh Stanley for tech assistance. I'm Ellen Gabler.
I'm Lisa Desai. You've been listening to Uptown Radio, a production of Columbia Radio News in New York City. Join us again next week, Friday at 4 p.m. Have a great weekend.